Good afternoon, Australia. Good evening, America. And welcome to all of you listening live online today on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitch, and Twitter. Oh, no, not Twitter. Twitch and YouTube. Yeah, yes, Twitch and YouTube. As you can see, I'm a little bit rough around the edges today. Can I say that this morning my little darling dog woke me at 4:45 in the morning, and we'd had a late night last night, and so today it's like the middle of the day, and I'm feeling like I should be finishing for the day, which is not good. So, in preparation for this show today to talk to Lisa, I started to look at our talking points, and we're talking about heart-centered leadership, but today we wanted to focus on where spirituality filled tied in with heart-centered leadership. Anyway, when I was looking for heart-centered leadership, lo and behold, what popped up but the podcast version of this very show, which made me extraordinarily happy. So thank you, everyone who's listening live and everyone who has listened to the podcast post-show. Thank you very much. It's awesome. I am delighted to be doing a show with Lisa. And before we go forward, I just want to remind you that Lisa Coletta is the CEO and Managing Director of the Governance Collective, and she is passionate about talking all things governance and leadership, and she does it really, really well. She's worked in both the public and private sector. She's worked with CEOs, advising chairs, boards, committees, managing directors, and executives on corporate governance, HR, and delivery of business strategy. She holds a multiple bucket load of fancy, wonderful management and governance degrees. And I know that each week when I talk to her, I find out something new that I didn't know before. So this week, we wanted to continue with the heart-centered leadership conversation and follow on from what we talked about last week. So last week we talked about those hard conversations. We talked about heart-centered versus ego-centered leadership, and we talked about what it means to deliver those hard conversations as a heart-centered leader and about how difficult that can be. Now, before we get into this heart-centered leadership space again, we were talking earlier. Lisa and I get together before the show to discuss what we want to particularly talk about. And this week we wanted to tie in the conversation about spiritual leaders. And again, when I was looking for key information, research, blogs, articles where leadership was referred to in terms of incorporating spirituality, it was actually a little bit more difficult than I anticipated. So when you Google search for some of that content, a lot of leadership in terms of spiritual leaders comes up, but it's in terms of churches and religion. And that's not really where we wanted to come from today. So we actually wanted to talk about heart-centered leaders who incorporate that conversation about spirituality into their workplace. And I actually was a bit perplexed that they seem to separate the two concepts when, in fact, I actually believe that they should be talked about together. So I'm going to hand over to Lisa to start a conversation today, and she might be able to give rationale to why my research turned up the lack of connectivity between leadership conversation and spiritual conversation. So, good morning, Lisa.
Good morning. How are you, Tony? You sound okay, given that you've had a bit of a rough morning.
That wonderful spiritual tip-off that you got me onto has been saying that perhaps I would feel this way today, so I'm just going to go with that, hey?
Look, everyone is feeling it today for lots of different reasons. It's a really interesting thing, and we would kind of think back to our conversation on Monday and around how tough the year has been and how so many facets of the individuals around us that we may or may not have been aware of have actually kind of come to the surface this year. And when you talk about jumping online and looking for a link between spirituality and leadership, my view is part of the reason why it's not there is because there's almost an expectation that we leave that part of ourselves at home when we come to work every day. It's kind
Wondered.
of one of those things, and I do see why you've actually found a lot around religion. And there is, in
Yes.
my point of view, a difference between religion and spirituality.
Absolutely.
And so when we come to work every day, we actually come as whole humans. I'm not sure whether you leave any part of yourself at home when you come to work. We're whole people. We're a whole people. We may not be whole in some ways, but we are we bring our mind, our body, and our spirit with us to work every day. Where our spirit goes, it's almost like I think for some leaders that they actually park that part of themselves at the door because in some environments, there's no place for it. There's no place or no created environment to have these kind of conversations. But for me and for the types of leaders that I tend to work around,
Yes.
spirituality, while it isn't actually talked about, actually is demonstrated in lots of different ways within the workplace. And that is the difference between what they're doing and how they're being. And I know
Yes.
we talked about this concept, Tony, a little bit about the doing and the being. And that concept that for some, there's a school of thought around the doing being your masculine self and how your being as being the feminine self. And every human walking on this earth have a masculine and a feminine side to who they are. For some individuals, their masculine selves are much, much, much more raised in consciousness than their feminine selves. So they're those people that actually do, but haven't quite got the same level of maturity around how they're being or same level of awareness around how they're being. And that's actually part of the reason why some of the work we do at the Governance Collective links the what they're doing with how they're being into being a heart-centered governing leader. Because how they're
Yes.
being is fundamental in motivating and driving the delivery of outcomes from the humans that they're working around.
And that's what I was looking for, is that we need to talk about humanity as a whole, and that incorporates a spirituality or a spiritual conversation, because we're not just two-dimensional. Humans are not two-dimensional. We need to talk about that idea of a greater consciousness, or acknowledgement that there's something outside of us that governs who we are as human beings. And you can not believe in it, and you can say that it doesn't exist or has no role in the corporate sector. But what Lisa and I are suggesting, that you can't do heart-centered leadership without this conversation around humanity. Humans are all those elements, and you can't lead them if you don't have that understanding. And again, saying that, oh, you don't believe in religion is not what we're trying to get at. We're trying to consider that greater connection between your mind, body, and soul, or as Lisa likes to say, that heart, head, gut conversation. So, Lisa, what do you mean when you talk about the heart, head, gut conversation?
So it's a really interesting concept. And what we've found is that some individuals are very, very good at internalizing and going within. And they think about what's coming, it comes up for them, an idea comes up or a reaction or a response comes up in some way, shape, or form. And they feel that it's actually logical, it's actually meaningful and logical to them from a pure head standpoint. And sometimes, unfortunately, our heads can betray us because there's a component of our idea of ourselves and our idea of the dynamics, and perhaps even being triggered by certain negative experiences from the past that can actually come into that thinking in the headspace. So a little bit of the ego can sometimes be coming, negative ego can actually come from the headspace. And so sometimes if we're just doing the doing and only purely checking in with our heads are going to go bang, 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 bang. But without
Yes.
going, wait a minute, from a pure heart-centered standpoint, is this the best position or the best outcome that we can be? You then actually check in from a heart space standpoint. and recognize that, wait a minute, there's me, but then there's also we. And am I making
Yes.
the decision from a me standpoint or from a we standpoint for the greater good of the collective being my team, my family, whatever the actual nature of the decision and the environment is, and be really clear about where your true decision-making intentions are coming from. The third aspect is your gut. And your gut is, you know, some people's guts actually speak more loudly than others. Some people are great at listening to their gut. The gut feeling can sometimes be read to be their intuition or that gut feel or that past experience. There's a whole heap of different things where the gut actually comes from. And what I suggest when I talk about the head, the heart, and the gut is that great decision making in life in general, not just within the corporate or work environment, comes from an alignment of what your head thinks, what your heart thinks, and what your gut thinks. Because the more you actually have that alignment between your head, your heart, and your gut, the more congruence you actually have internally.
Yes.
You know, sometimes when you make a decision and you go, oh, that was the right thing, but something doesn't sit quite right, you know that feeling you get? Typically you get that incongruence within you because your head's telling you this, and sometimes your head can actually betray you because it's jumping to conclusions like, oh, if you do this, they'll do that, and they'll do this and they'll do that. So you've got to be ready to fight because they're going to, and you actually don't know whether they're going to or they're not going to. So you make decisions head-wise that potentially react to scenarios or situations that may not even play out. So that nice check-in around what's my head saying, what's my heart saying, what's my gut saying is really, really important. And also recognizing as part of that process that there's this internalized view of me, and then there's this broader heart-centered view of what the impacts are of the we, of us as a collective. And there are a few different ways people can actually check in on themselves to do that if they're not familiar with those kinds of processes. A great way is meditation. So for those who haven't actually practiced or learned how to meditate, there's lots of really great tools out there. You can learn one-on-one and do, you know, a course or something like that. There's a lot of great tools online that you can jump in and consider. But it is really getting clear about the inner voice and where is that inner voice actually coming from, and whether that inner voice is actually coming from a place of true and good intentions. And if those intentions are coming from somewhere that aren't pure, you will get that incongruence in you. And we all know how that feels. Sometimes my kids kind of define it as buyer's remorse. They're like, oh, I really wanted it at the time, so I reacted and I bought it, and then I've, you know, spent my last $50 from my birthday money, and I've come home and gone, I just really regret it. Yeah, that feeling of, oh, and it's because at that time they might have been driven because their friends had that item or whatever it is that they made them buy it in that moment. But it's kind of, you know, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago around trust, when you're having these interfaces and these conversations, getting really great congruence within yourself and having true heart-centered but aligned conversations is important because they build trust. However, having misalignment and just coming from your head and reacting breaks trust. And Tony, we know how hard it is to build trust, and we know how easy and how fast it is to lose trust very, very fast. You lose trust really quickly. So that's the nature of that head, heart, and gut.
So, Lisa, you've worked with lots and lots of corporations, CEOs, and people in high levels of leadership. How hard is it to put this heart-centered leadership into practice? Because for people who've done a lot of work on themselves and had to do a lot of self-reflection, self-growth, self-development, yes, that's easier. But not everyone's been down that path, yet they've still risen to a corporate level, or a CEO or director of a board. How difficult is it to start that conversation and start those leaders looking within themselves a bit more?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Tony. In my experience, those leaders tend to have some sort of trigger or wake-up point where they realize that their idea of themselves, their idea of themselves that's based on ego, isn't really their true selves. Excuse me. Yeah. It isn't really their true selves. Straight to the throat, right?
Yes.
And because of that, what tends to happen is that they might have a 360 degree survey, like we talked about last week, or some other process that alerts them to the fact that they thought that things were a certain way and they had these certain ideas about themselves. And those ideas don't actually align with perhaps what their true self is telling them now or what the reality is based on the feedback of people around them and how they're being received. So in a lot of cases, they get that wake-up call that way.
Yes.
Some leaders also, I find, just know, even though it might never come out of their mouths, they just know within themselves that there has to be another way, but they've never had modeling of better behavior and they've had people around them who have behaved the same way and it's enabled them to get to that level. So they kind of
Yes.
believe in hype, if you know what I mean. oh, you're so great. Well, thank you. I'm just so great. And
Yeah.
they can and do that. In my experience, it's never too late to start these conversations and learning about yourself. There's a really interesting dynamics that do play out from time to time that are a very heavy leveler. And
Yes.
give you a personal example. My father has passed away now. He was a very senior leader in a large organization. And when he retired, he didn't have a huge amount of hobbies and he lost his identity. And it happens to a lot of people, males especially, because males tend to attach who they are to what they do. And we know that that happens because whenever we go to a dinner party, I don't know if you've been to a lot of dinner parties lately. I know I haven't been to a huge amount, but when I do, when
Not
I
lately.
meet people, not lately, what tends to happen when you meet people for the first time is that the guys will get together, shake hands when they're allowed to shake hands, COVID free,
Yes.
of course, and they
Yes.
shake hands. They say, "Hi, I'm Mike." "Oh, what do you do for a cross, Mike?" "Oh, I do XYZ." So who they are and what they do is automatically attached to their image of themselves.
Right, yes.
So
Very
when I go to those parties, I find it really interesting. I find it quite fascinating because I'll go to my husband's parties and they know my husband and the first thing they'll ask me is, "Who are you and how many kids do you have and how long have you been married and do I like living in the suburb I live in?" They don't ask me what I do, because they don't see the image of me being beyond a female interfacing for the first time. So
goodness,
I
so
very
true.
rarely, so I very rarely say, "Hi, I'm Lisa. I'm the managing director and founder of the Governance Collective, and I've been running the business for 2 years, and we do XYZ." The identity of self actually is different. I'm actually a lot of things. I'm a wife, I'm a daughter, I'm a mother, I'm a sister, I'm an auntie, I'm a whole heap of things. And I also happen to be the managing director of the Governance Collective. When my
Yeah.
father lost, when my father retired, he lost that part of himself and he lost that identity that actually was attached to his ego. So he could no longer walk around using that badge of, So he started using the "I was the blah blah blah," and but now I'm retired. So he still had to attach himself to what he did as being part of the image of who he was. The great leveler for
Yeah.
my dad was when he had grandchildren, because what can happen, and I know that this happens in some dynamics, but not in all. My dad worked really, really hard when we were young. We didn't see much of him. But of
Yeah.
course, he was retired and then he had grandchildren. And so my children and my brother's children all got to appreciate my dad as an amazing grandfather. But we would look at the
Yeah.
things he did with them and we go, "God, Dad never did that stuff with us."
Yeah.
And that leveler for my dad was that he actually had to, my children and my nephews and nieces, they didn't care what job he held. And they also didn't actually care about what his ego thought of himself. He actually had to be quite humanistic to be able to interface and relate to his grandchildren. So my dad's
Yeah.
level was that. And that was actually it was a big change, Tony. So leaders
Yes.
can find it quite hard to go, okay, I think the first step is really realizing and having some sort of trigger to go, okay, time for a change, Tony, time for a change.
Yes. And I guess that you have to be open to starting to think about that change, thinking about, gosh, I've got to this level. That's really good. There has to be something else. Something's got to change. And then going, okay, right, what needs to change? Because not everyone does that, do they?
Look, they don't, especially because some individuals are so externally focused and they actually believe the hype so much that they're not used to actually looking at themselves. They're actually very, very fast, super, super skilled and fast to actually put everything on everyone else. Everything that's happening with them, it's everyone else's problem or everyone else's fault. So they don't actually own their piece. And we talked a little bit last week about, what part do you own and what part does someone else own? And don't get me wrong, there are, factors that, play into account where others are actually, doing in a, doing things, throwing things your way or, throwing your stuff your way energetically or whatever else. But what can happen is that some of those really senior leaders, they've never taken accountability for themselves and their own behavior their whole lives. No one would dare ever try and pin anything on them because they felt they were untouchable and there was always a scapegoat and someone else would always lose their job when something went wrong and they were always in a position of authority and to be able to control dynamics so that they were always untouchable. And when you're used to having your own way and you're used to being totally untouchable all of your career, and all of a sudden you're confronted with the fact that, guess what? I'm actually not the person I thought I was. And there's actually two other components of myself, my inner self, that I've never stopped to listen to. It can be quite confronting. Now, what does my heart really want? And what does my gut really say? Sometimes, in fairness too, though, Tony, some of the more egocentric head kind of individuals, they actually do have head and they do have gut. They miss heart. So they'll
So it
go.
really,
Yeah. Sorry.
they really need the three to lead well, don't they? Like we're talking about functional leadership that works for the company, the employees, the managers, everyone. This is we're talking about, good leadership.
Absolutely. And the reason why they need all three is because hearts talk to hearts, Tony. Egos talk to egos and hearts talk to hearts. And if you really want to have a great, real relationship with your employees or with your customers and build great rapport, you need to recognize that all three components of you and that alignment of who you are. When that alignment is there, you have complete authenticity. You're actually standing up and stepping forward as your true higher self, heart-centered self.
That's the ultimate aim for every human being alive is to walk through life from that space. Do you find it harder for men to have these conversations versus women, or are we seeing a gradual change?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I would say we are seeing a gradual change. I have been in some environments recently where I've been really pleasantly surprised that some of these conversations, some of these real conversations, tend to be a bigger aha moment for some of the females than the males. I think there's actually typically quite a mix. I do find though that the egocentric leaders tend to be at the higher ends of the organization. In other words, they are the CEOs or they are the members of the board, or the board or the chair, or the business owner. And look, it's interesting. I know we touched on it a couple of shows ago. There is, I think, a lot to say about this leveling up between the masculine and the feminine within ourselves, and the leveling up between the way the males are operating in our society and the way the females are operating in our society. Because we talk about the females leveling up and being equal level, recognizing the we over the me. There has been some, I guess, dynamics playing out where females feel that their ability to rise actually means that they're actually dominating over the males, and they're kind of missing that, fundamental what's the greater good for everyone point, and that is that there's equilibrium between. So it's actually quite interesting. In saying that though, Tony, there was an article that I read a couple of weeks ago. I might actually put it in my blog if I remember to do that, of course. The article, not the blog. The blog will happen. There was an article around how there's been a really great increase in the number of females on boards. In
Yes.
fact, the last survey they did that was outlined in this article said that there was a 30% increase in the number of females,
Yeah.
which is actually really, really pleasing. However, the disappointing part was that those females have been brought in by those white male privileged individuals, and they're only hiring females that are exactly the white same way they are.
Yes.
So the females
Yes.
are behaving the way the males are, and that change within the boardroom to actually bring that diversity in isn't actually playing out, because all they've done is they've opened the boys' club up to let the girls in
Yes.
that play like the boys. And so once the girls that are in, they can say, oh, it's a number that we have to hit. Great, we've got, 50% male, 50% female. But it's about that real diversity as opposed to the hire in my own image diversity, which seems to be playing out right now within board environments.
I was going to say, going back to that wonderful book Untamed by Glennon Doyle, and that whole conversation around what is feminine, what is masculine, and hey, let's not label them feminine or masculine, they are human traits. So we need to get to the point where weakness and sensitivity, so sensitivity rather, is not seen as a feminine trait. It's a human trait where we see all those wonderful, heartfelt feelings as human traits, not feminine or masculine traits. And it's a
Absolutely.
wonderful con because I feel, as I know you feel, that we are entering the age where the patriarchy is ceasing to be the predominant way of thinking, and we are leveling up. And as we level up, we need to make sure that our men are enabled to lead with leadership qualities that include vulnerability and sympathy and understanding and empathy and all those beautiful human traits versus feminine traits. And I know that you work in this area all the time, so I was very curious to see if we're starting to see some of those changes. I know from people that I've talked to, it's not necessarily happening. And in some Western and Eastern countries, it's a long way off. So I'm hoping that you and I will see it in this next decade, where there is that leveling up and evening out, and where women are employed as all the unique capacities and skills that they bring to an organization versus the fact that they're female, that we start to have conversations about what you do, and it doesn't matter whether you're male or female, how many kids you've got. This is you, and you're a unique human being. So again, all of those conversations that are inherent in Glennon's book are kind of the things that we've been successively talking about over this our series together around heart-shaped leadership.
Absolutely. I definitely agree with you, and I can't help but feel that the part of our actual challenge around all of this is actually the language we use and what we call it. Just because we're talking, I started our show off by saying every single human on this earth, regardless of whether they're male or female, have a masculine and feminine component to them. And
I do.
because I use the word feminine doesn't mean they're female. Just because I use the
Yeah.
masculine doesn't mean they're female. I can tell you that early in my career, as I've freely shared with your listeners, I had a
Yeah.
very masculine self was very, very high. My feminine self was very, very low. And I've been working really hard over the last couple of years, probably the last 8 or 9 years now, to recognize that how I be while I do is incredibly important. And it's not about me being more feminine, because during that whole time, I identified as a female. So I knew I was a female and identified as a female. So it's that language of whether a feminine means female, because I think that the point Glennon is making is that just because how they be, how men be, is kind of being labeled as these feminine traits is actually not the right word for it. And I'm actually kind of struggling to find out what the right word is, but it's not feminine. It's actually
No.
humanistic. It's heart-centered and
Yes.
humanistic. And we talked
Heart.
earlier. Yeah.
Right. So
Yeah.
the I kind of get from that whole conversation that we need to embrace people as humans first. And as a human, you will have a diverse range of traits, and they should not be labeled as either masculine or feminine. They should be just beautiful human traits, every single one of them. And we will each uniquely have them in different levels, and they will mean different things in our lives. And again, that whole conversation about how we bring up our boys and what we teach our boys around being a strong, good human being versus boys will be boys. You know, it's a very important conversation to have, because we want to start having those education talks with our boys so that they become the leaders of the future, so that they become heart-centered leaders. Not that they're a man or a woman, but they are heart-centered, because that's the best thing for humanity.
Absolutely. And the same goes for our girls. I have a son and a daughter, and I have these conversations, unfortunately for them, pretty regularly, because I sort of stand up and say to them, to my daughter, look, I learned the hard way that I can do everything. Sorry, I can do anything, but I can't do everything. I
Yeah,
can do
and
it,
not all at once.
and not all at once. I can do anything, I can't do everything. I was actually told that by a CEO that I was working for about 7 or 8 years ago. And I remember walking out of the room being slightly confused because I'm like, does that mean I'm doing a good job or I'm not doing a good job? Because he complimented me, but then he also didn't compliment me. And I wasn't really sure how to take it at the time, but I stand back from it. And he was absolutely right. I can. I have the capability of doing anything, but I can't do
Yes.
everything. And so that doing, and that alignment with how I'm being and being really clear about where my head and my heart and my gut is really
Yeah.
fundamental for me to be an authentic, good human walking around on this earth. And when I talk to my daughter, I don't want my daughter to be too masculine and feel she needs to play the boy game. But at the same time, I know that that word masculine isn't really the right word. I really want my daughter and my son to be able to have that
Yes.
beautiful congruence and beautiful balance within themselves, and they're considering not only in the internal factors but also the external factors. But those external factors are actually not about what everyone else will think, and let's change our mind and be ready to respond to what other people think. But what is it that they think, and how does that sit in the context of the broader community or the broader environment that they're actually operating in? It's really, really important. How are they contributing to that?
Do you think this that these concepts of heart-centered leadership are filtering through to some of the bigger corporations? And I ask this from purely a personal perspective. My husband works for a huge multinational conglomerate, and it's very evident to me that the leaders above him are just deplorable human beings. And there's a number in the team that are really struggling with this whole scenario. And I actually, after talking to you, I started to think, okay, so we need to think about how they can approach this. And it suddenly occurred to me, they have a governance structure, they have a code of conduct slash code of ethics. I need to find that and give it to you guys, and you need to read it and go, ah, they really are not leading us according to company values and ethics. And
Absolutely.
under that scenario, you can push back and go, okay, this is not working because da 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 da. And it's made his day,
Oh, look,
quite
I don't
frankly.
think that it has, because keeping in mind that if they have the right governance structure in place, those policies or those code of ethics and code of conduct and all those kind of things, they're actually approved by the board.
They are.
The
They've
board have actually
all signed up.
they all signed off. So the board have actually drawn a line around the behaviour that's expected of everyone in the organisation. And typically those
Yes.
behaviors are actually aligned to the board code of conduct, because the board will also have a code of conduct around how they need to behave as well. And so,
True.
keeping in mind, of course, that the behavior we walk past is the behavior we choose to accept, somewhere within the
Yeah.
chain of the organizational environment that your husband works in isn't behaving appropriately. And no one's drawn that line and said, look, you've crossed this line, and it's a line that, isn't appropriate to cross. It's actually a term of your employment. And let's have a conversation around what better behavior looks like. I guess to come back to your question, Tony, the answer is unfortunately no. There are large organizations out there where people are not behaving well. And even from an employer of choice standpoint, like I know a couple of financial institutions in particular, and a couple of consultancy, large top four consultancy firms, four, five, six, level fives and six, who are actually known. They're synonymous for chewing people up and spitting people out. That's what they're known for. And people are actually attracted to the roles in these environments because they figure that if I could, they can survive 2 or 3 years there, it actually looks really good on their resume that they've actually been able to handle being in these types of environments. Whereas I kind of stand back and go, wow, you're going to have 3 years of hell. You're doing it for career enhancement purposes. I actually don't know that your mental health, your physical and mental well-being is actually worth that.
I get really, I'd forgotten how much I loved working and thinking in that space, in that corporate level. And for me to be able to go through and find their policy, find their code of conduct, then reference it back to the behaviors that was happening, I got really excited. I'm like, I can't wait to talk to Lisa on the show today about this because and there's a certain, so there's a certain reluctance to call them out on their behaviors until I pointed out you guys are actually protected by this structure sitting over here under your human resources. And if you don't, or as a team, try and stop this behavior, it's just going to go on and on. So that's not, people are reluctant to call out that bad behavior. And if you've got a big corporate structure, rest assured that they will have processes in place. They may not work really well, and you may have heard down the chain or in the tea room that, oh, it's no use doing XYZ. But actually, it is, because each time you call out that bad behavior, it makes it better for someone else in the organization. It makes the world a better place.
Oh,
And could
absolutely.
not be living in a or working in corporations that don't value the importance of their employees and their thoughts around certain management strategies and the way that they treat people. This is no longer okay. We live in a wonderful big world where there is plenty of information about what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And so I really think that we should be encouraging everyone to say, hey, no, that's not okay. You can't treat people like that. And particularly hardworking, high level, well educated, very intelligent groups of teams, you can't treat them that way and think that you're going to get away with it, even
I
though you've
think,
got away with it for a certain amount of time.
yeah, well, I think in fairness to the teams too, Tony, sometimes this kind of behaviors, they're not revolutionary, they're evolutionary. So over time, some small little behaviors played out and that's been okay. And then over time it builds and builds and builds and builds until all of a sudden you stand back and go, whoa, wait a minute. We're happy, we're okay about it playing at this level, but all of a sudden it's gotten here now. And it actually crosses several lines. And I would say to those team members that are sort of sitting there going, I know I've got these mechanisms in place, but I don't feel I have a voice. There's a couple of things to actually consider. For some environments, there are whistleblower provisions that actually provide them an opportunity to be able to speak up confidentially.
Yes.
Typically, individuals, because organisations, now here in Australia especially, need to have a whistleblower policy that enables individuals to be able to speak up.
I actually couldn't find their harassment and bullying policy. The links were all done, like they just went.
Yeah, you might find that sometimes it gets buried in their grievance policy as well. So you might want to have a look at the grievance policy if that sometimes they can be buried there. Yeah. So it might be there.
Okay.
I would definitely have a look there. I think the other thing too to consider for those individuals that are thinking about speaking up, be really clear about your own behaviour first. And the reason why I say that is because, harking back to Ashe from last week, it
Yes.
takes two to tango. And so it's
Yeah.
very easy to point the finger at others, but at the same time, you've actually got to, excuse my language, own your own crap. And it's
Oh,
painful to own
yeah.
sometimes. And I'm not suggesting in any means that your husband's an example of this, Tony, because I don't know your husband. But sometimes you've actually got to stand back and go, I've contributed to this and I need to
Yeah.
own my part of it. And so as part
Yeah.
of own your part, own it openly and proudly. If you are worried about speaking up, if you need to use courage to speak up, it actually says a lot about your culture because you only
Yeah.
need courage in an environment where there's fear.
Yes.
And if there
That's
is
pretty much
fear playing out within
described.
the yeah, if there is fear playing out within the culture, it means that it's not a very well motivated environment, and it means that the intentions of driving the organization forward and having great morale and a great culture is not being delivered. So you may find
That
that,
would be, I would describe
absolutely. And one of the other things you might find as a really constructive mechanism is to have a look at what the organization's strategy is. Because typically, organizations have multiple faceted strategies that include culture-based work. So there's a saying, and I'm probably going to get it wrong. I think it might have been, I'm not sure who actually said it. It's jumped out of my brain right now. But culture
Yeah.
eats strategy for dinner. So if culture, I think it might have been Drucker, culture eats strategy for dinner. So if the culture is aligned to the strategy and the strategic direction to drive the organization forward, the strategy will never be realized. So typically, within the strategy, they have a culture and a change piece around realigning the culture to where the organization needs or wants to go. And I am really referring to those larger end organizations and multinational conglomerates. They tend to have
Yes.
multifaceted strategies that go, we're going to drive here, but we also know that the culture has to come with us. Otherwise, we're not going to be able
Yes.
to meet our requirements and meet the demand of whatever we're generating. So great mechanisms might exist within the strategy that will enable team members and team leaders and senior leaders to say, hey, as a component of this strategy, we need to work on our culture because there are great opportunities to enhance our culture to a place and space where everyone is actually moving forward in the same direction and we're all behaving the same way.
Yeah,
One of
yeah.
the things it actually does, Tony, is it actually takes it from a negative, I'm going to dob and report conversation to a proactive look, guys, we are where we are right now. I want to drive us forward in the organization, and maybe a more constructive way is to kind of call it out in a way that says, we need to achieve this. Unless certain types of dynamics change, we don't believe we're going to get where we're going unless we can deliver against a strategy.
That's the exactly what they're trying to do at the moment. Is
Yeah.
say this is not working for this particular team because of X,
Yeah.
Y, Z, P, Q. We
Yeah.
think going forward that this should be the strategy. Can we talk about that? The trouble has been engaging and
Engaging.
getting that,
Yeah,
yes,
and
getting that
keep in
talk
mind,
happening.
yeah, absolutely. Keeping in mind too that there is a hierarchy. So, provided that they're focusing, and this is my own personal experience, provided that we're focusing on process and not attacking people. And you constructively raise your concerns and issues with your leader. Say
That's
again.
what they're trying to avoid. They're trying to avoid that this is what these are the
Stop.
behaviors that happening. They're trying to avoid that and
Yeah.
develop a strategy around that.
Absolutely. Some of these larger organizations too have what I term as an MOR process. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of an MOR process before. It's
No.
actually a process where the manager, once removed from the direct manager,
Yes.
meets with the employees once or twice a year to learn about, to understand their, to help them succession
That's
plan and to have those
that is
goals.
happening.
Yeah.
That's happening at the
If
moment.
that's happening, that's actually really great, because what it means is that you are not only developing a relationship, a meaningful relationship with your leader, but also the next leader up. So what you can do, if you feel you need to and you can do it constructively, I would recommend that you would actually advise your leader, look, I think this and this and this, give him some time to perhaps implement some of your suggested changes. If you're finding that they're
Yes.
feeling and they're not actually escalating your concerns, or the opportunities up in a way that you'd kind of expect, and you don't feel satisfied that your leader's getting where you need to go, typically the MOR process is an opportunity for you to be able to raise it. But I would recommend, out of complete and utter respect and out of, I guess, courtesy, that you let your leader
Yes.
know that you're going to be mentioning that at your next MOR meeting, so that they're aware that you are actually escalating it to the next level. And they're not surprised when their leader comes and knocks on the door and says, "Hey, Tony, I hear Lisa's told you XYZ. It's a great idea. Why haven't you moved on it?" Happen, right? Totally happen. So, yeah.
Do you find that when you go into, I guess it would be boards, committees, corporations, anything, do you find some of these little issues hanging around in the background that nobody wants to talk about and nobody wants to do anything about?
I do quite regularly, and what I typically find is that everyone agrees with what's actually being said, but they just don't know what to do about it, Tony. There's no mechanism for them to be able to raise it in a constructive way that means that not only are they hearing it, but they're actually moving it beyond everyone being aware that that's a problem and no one doing anything about it. So we spend quite a bit of time helping businesses not just have the right policy, but have the right mechanisms to be able to escalate up chain. So the right people know about the right things, the right decision makers with the right authority can do something about the things that get raised. One of the great examples of that is that better organizations, we find, have a bit of a temperature check process. Some of them run it weekly or fortnightly, where they send a survey out. I mean, something as simple as a little SurveyMonkey survey out to all of their employees, and they ask them what they think, what the employees think are the top issues and the top opportunities in the organization that's been playing around them. And that data is actually utilized for a few things. First of all, if your employees are on the call front, they're actually facing your customers, they're getting feedback from the customers all the time. So when they are hearing the same thing over and over, our customers would really love us to do XYZ, that's actually a great opportunity for a new product or a new service that you wouldn't normally get escalated up. So it's a great opportunity. The same thing can happen for things that are actually on the negative, and it actually helps you feed your risk management processes. So whenever we go into an organization and we put in a risk management framework, you don't just, organizations assess their risks in certain sort of time sequences, like 3 monthly or 6 monthly or whatever else. This pulse check process really enables the leaders who manage risks to understand what's actually potentially coming up. So they're less surprised because there's less unknown unknowns. It was an unknown and then known, and you've got a bit of a lead time to go, okay, we know that this seems to be happening, or we've noticed that three people mentioned this last survey, but now 25 people are saying this. There's concerns that X, Y, and Z are going to happen, and this is an issue that we need to deal with. And how does it link to our risk framework and our existing strategic risks? And how does it impact the delivery of our strategy? And so there's great mechanisms like that. What do those kind of mechanisms also let you do, Tony, which is really important? I personally find that it's very important, is that it enables everyone in the organization who wants a voice to have a voice And you're not relying on the team member to communicate to the team leader and expect the team leader to have a care factor and then escalate it up, because leaders naturally filter. And as we've talked about, some individuals prefer to push the good news up and the bad news down. And so leaders could be blocking them right now. Whereas this mechanism, I find that audit committees, audit and risk committees love this mechanism because they're hearing from a cross range of staff and it's unfiltered information that leadership, the management and leaders aren't able to actually block or change. So quite a great
Have
mechanism, as you can see, quite enthusiastic about it.
you ever been into an organization where you've come across the results of a survey that have shown XYZ and no one's ever done anything with it?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, that is the bane of all survey takers. I actually was working in one organization that used to survey us constantly, and we had such survey fatigue. We were sick of doing surveys. We never saw the results, and we don't think they did anything about it. It was almost like there was a KPI to do a survey, not actually care what the outcomes of the survey were. Great design surveys actually drive towards an outcome. And I think in that particular case, the surveys weren't well designed. They just wanted to know answers to questions and what everyone felt about things. And it was almost like they didn't start with the end in mind when it came to designing a great survey. So that can definitely happen. One of the other things we find a lot of is that lots of outstanding audit items. It's kind of one of those things. Audit recommendations are made, and leaders come and leaders go. And I remember starting a new role in one organization. I inherited seven audit reports. One was a re-audit. No, two was a re-audit of the first audit. So three of them was the same audit, but they just found more and more problems because nothing was addressed. And I had four
Oh,
other
no.
audits. So my gift from the retiring manager was all these audit reports, and they are the things that really, quite frankly, excuse me, can bite you in the backside when you least expect.
Absolutely.
And
Absolutely.
I was actually audited 3 weeks after starting my new job. And I sort of said, I was fortunate that the previous leader gave me the audit reports. Otherwise, I would have had no awareness of inheriting this big bucket of mess, which is what it was. And of course, the challenge too, Tony, for some of us leaders is if we're not great at speaking up and having that true alignment between our head and our heart and our guts, we end up being the recipient of stuff that we don't agree with, and then we do nothing about it, and it comes back to haunt us anyway. So that incongruence between ourselves and not speaking up clearly means that at some point or another, you're going to have to deal with it, because this stuff follows you around until you do, until you get the lesson, until you actually do it.
Yeah.
Learn it the hard way,
Lisa,
right?
I know. We have talked so much this morning that we are just about out of time already. Now, next week is our last show, but what we're going to do is open the phone lines, the Zoom lines, and the email lines for people to ask Lisa any questions that you'd like to know. You can join us on the program. We're going to put the details out on the website and also through our social media, or you can email Lisa on support@governance.com or me on info@radiotony.com with any of the things that you'd like to discuss or the questions you might have around heart-centered leadership and governance. So, Lisa, thank you so much once again this week for another wonderful conversation about governance, heart-centered leadership, and everything else in between. We will be back next week, same time, same show, for Lisa Coletta from the Governance Collector, Collective, rather. Radio Tony, Everyday Business. We'll be back again next week. Thank you so much, Lisa. Over to you, TJ.